with 21 correspondents in 7 countries from around the world. This is Bondi Tunes International.
Thomas Booker is Bondi Tunes International. He's our North American correspondent, and he joins us now from Texas.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry on Bondi Beach, the beautiful Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia, where currently the weather is nice as we head into winter, but it's actually late autumn, at 22 Celsius, clear skies. I'm joined by Thomas Booker, who is our North America correspondent in San Antonio de Bayar in Texas. Hey, how you doing?
Not too bad, not too shabby, not too shabby.
I heard you were grumpy.
I am grumpy, yes.
Yeah,
we're not going to talk politics.
We're not, but I'm not going to talk about it now, as you said on your promo.
Not going to talk about it now.
I'm not. I want to talk about life, actually. You know, if I was born in 1982, I'd be a millennial. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't know what a tape recorder was. I probably would, but wouldn't know how to use it. I would know what a vinyl record was because they've come back in. I wouldn't know what a rotary dial phone was. Do you feel a bit sorry for the young'uns?
Not especially. it wasn't all that great. We were pretty primitive. I have my own little fond memories of watching, old movies on a black and white TV, tube television set.
Oh, yes.
I watched Superman when it was actually a running series, real time.
Yeah. In black and white.
In black and white, of course. There was no other way to do it. Mm. And
do you think the kids are? I mean, look, we sound old fashioned when we say this. If they were to listen to us now, they go, "Oh, whatever." But you know, I sort of think they are. I mean, I'm a little bit younger than you, but I grew up with, all this technology. And it was technology at the time. It was cutting edge, wasn't it, Thomas?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was downright righteous. We basically had AM radio, and we had a radio in the car, which was a big deal. I actually was there for the transistor era, even though the TV sets we bought initially in our family, when I was very young, we're all vacuum tube, and that was the this is the old story. You had to turn the TV on
and wait,
and then wait for 30 seconds for the tubes to warm up,
and the little white light in the middle of the screen.
Yeah. then slowly it would turn into a line and then become a picture, and they were very primitive. I mean, they TV sets crapped out all the time, and that was the position of dad having to go open up the back of the TV set and take all the tubes out and go down to the convenience store where they had tube testers. And he would plug the tubes in and look up the number on the tube and twirl that in and then and there would be a meter there that would say good and then gassy and bad. And he would buy replacement tubes and they would come home and stick them all back into the TV set.
Were you one of these people who sort of banged televisions, and adjusted the rabbit's ears?
The rabbit ears were, yes, they were a problem.
You'd
yes,
have to move them.
Really did use tin foil on the rabbit ears, yes.
Let's go back to the 1940s, because now, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're a science type and you probably know more about this than me, but television, the Americans claim that they invented television. When in fact, I believe, now this is pre-World War II, that a Scottish man invented television. Then the war came and everything halted.
Well, there were two versions of it. The American inventor was Philo T. Farnsworth. And they both were using scans. I think the Scottish version was an electromechanical rig. There was some component you had to have a spinning motor in there. Because they transmitted the signal. The camera that took the picture also had a spinning disc on it that would chop the image up somehow and format that for transmitting. The thing that did it, Franklin Roosevelt opened up the New York World's Fair in 1939. It was a big deal. And he was the first president to be televised.
President Roosevelt, with his son John behind him on the right, speaks in the Court of Peace.
I hereby dedicate the World's Fair, the New York World's Fair of 1939, and I declare it open to all mankind.
The fair opens on the 150th anniversary of the inauguration of George Washington, and the father of his country looks out towards the British Pavilion, one of the outstanding exhibits in the world of tomorrow. And against the background of darkness, the New York World's Fair becomes a painting in light.
Wow. Which was, you know, kind of weird. So he made a speech there opening the ceremonies, and there is a what they call a kinescope, where they would take a film camera and put it in front of a screen, of a TV screen, and then the film you'd make a film of a TV screen. And that exists. I'm sure you can probably see it on YouTube.
But did anyone have television sets?
Yes. Well, we got ours. I was a very young kid. And what happened was, okay, you had World War II. And in Britain and in the United States, they were developing radar. And they and it was a big deal. So like everybody had radar sets, which was basically a big cathode ray tube. You know, you've seen them in all the old war movies and stuff with the lines scanning around when they're watching the radar looking for aircraft. Well, that was a cathode ray tube, which was the same as a TV screen that we know later. And what happened was when the World War II finally ended, all these factories retooled, and the factories that were making all the electronic equipment retooled over to making television tubes, and TV sets started coming out in the late 40s and early 50s, and then there was also the post-war prosperity, and that was when, you know, the United States had their standard television that was out, that was 535 line scan.
I thought it was 405.
Well, that was Britain had a different standard for their scan.
Right.
And so they had all of their televisions over there. That was one of the ways that the only way we could watch British television, and the only way they could watch American television was by kinescopes, because they watched they made films of it. But so those are the two standards. And they were kept all the way up until the point that HDTV and the new video standard we're looking at now came out. And so now all of our TVs are all of our video are standard.
You know what amazes me, Thomas, is how fast the Americans got onto television. Given that by the mid-1950s, I know most television was live. And the speed at, you know, you talked about, you know, the white picket fence era, the 1950s, which I want to talk to you about in more detail in a minute. But in terms of television, it moved so fast. You know, there was no television, then suddenly you've got Lucille Ball. it just came out of nowhere.
There was a night, it was the Korean War had been going. I was born in 1953, sometime later, I'm not too sure if my mother has had the recollections blurred or not, but supposedly the night they bought their first television set was the evening when they turned it on. They were having live broadcasts of Douglas MacArthur's farewell to Congress. And I'm not sure if that kind of I might have jived. I'll have to see I never really have gone back and looked at that carefully, but that was the first thing they watched on television. And then I guess later on they were watching the Army, you know, the House Un-American Activities,
and of course post-war propaganda as well.
Yes.
Someone told me that if you wanted to buy a television, that you kind of had to. I think it was like 4 months' wages, and you sort of had to pay it off very gradually.
Pay it on credit. Some people would buy it on credit, but then the whole thing was that the economy of the United States right after World War II, and it took a little while longer. Actually, Britain, it was really so, you know, badly hit that they actually didn't go off ration stamps from World War II until about the mid 50s.
That's absolutely right. Yeah,
and that was astonishing, and I really liked that. a documentary you made about Australia and about the rationing that went on there during during the war.
Yes,
That was a bit of a brilliant piece of work too.
Yeah, that was our correspondent in Spain, Carol Cotter, put that together. It's a very interesting piece, isn't it? It's just all about the rationing, and the war didn't end when the war ended, if you know what I mean, in Britain.
Gotcha.
I don't know about America. You had rationing there, obviously, but obviously
it ended shortly after the war. I mean, the United States of America had all. I mean, the thing was that all of the industry was cranked up. It was cranking stuff out, and the agriculture was cranked up. And so when there was this whole huge surplus of resources. So when the war ended, it took very little time. You know, it's like I was saying, they were selling TVs in the late 40s, and radio took off. So there was no problem with food or rationing or anything like that. That ended right quickly.
My grandfather said, of course, he was in theatre all his life, or most of his life. He used to actually travel around Ireland with a kind of a mobile entertainment centre, if you like. And he'd do these gigs, you know, in different places. And he said that television would kill theatre. How wrong? How wrong was he?
Oh, that's the funny part. The other funny part about it was... television did, television did threaten the motion picture industry.
Yes, he also said that, you know, the cinema would be killed off. Yeah,
cinema would be killed off. But that's the funny part about the motion picture industry. Suddenly had to come up with they had to make the motion pictures an event, and they had to be a long, drawn out, dramatic. And then they came up with the Technicolor and the VistaVision and the Cinerama. Mm. And so they started showing these really huge, long, drawn-out plot, spectacular movies, most of which were Bible movies. And
yes, a lot of Jesus on the cross kind of stuff going on.
A lot of Jesus on the cross. And then, just recently, we just finished Easter, and every year on Easter our ABC channel, the regular broadcast television, it still exists here, but for Easter they always show the Ten Commandments.
Yes.
Which was it was just the best god awful thing.
I can't watch that stuff.
Oh, it's cringeworthy. But so they had to outdo each other in terms of the spectacular motion picture spectacular, and so they were trying to make the theater experience more impactful than the TV set, which was just a little black and white screen that you had. You have to That's imagine. True. I'm looking at a screen, my PC, my Apple screen right now. Hmm. Retina's color screen is larger than the TV set. I think it was we had a 19-inch diagonal TV screen in the middle of it. Was in the middle of our little den area. And on that, the family would gather around. We watched the Beatles appear on the Ed Sullivan Show, and all everything else going on, the Kennedy assassination, all of that.
Oh, yes.
We were watching a small screen. I can't believe.
And it's kind of a roundy screen as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was curved in the edges. It was
Okay, I just want to let our listeners know, if you've just joined us, it's 12 minutes into this interview. I'm talking with our correspondent in Texas, San Antonio de Bayar, and Thomas Booker is his name. Just on that note about, you know, my grandfather saying, and many people saying, that television would kill the cinema. Now, there's a different reason why that could happen, because televisions are as big as your wall.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you've got super quality quadraphonic sound. Is it potentially possible that it could kill cinema now?
I'm thinking it is. I'm thinking they're in serious trouble, because yes, especially with all the streaming services and the quality of the picture, and the fact that you don't have to go to a theater and sit in a crowd, and also COVID has driven people
of course
out. And so yeah, I'm thinking that, and they've been talking about the Academy Awards being a they were concerned. I mean, it's an ongoing concern about why are they making this big stupid award ceremony when nobody.
And it was a disaster this year. I don't even want to go into that.
But the
thing is that television may well threaten cinemas. Interesting, you mentioned about them making big, long movies like Ben-Hur, which was as big as Ben-Hur. I mean, it created a phrase. And that you say that they sort of wanted to make these big blockbusters at the time. You know, like...
Yes, to draw the crowds back into the theaters.
And do you think that worked? It must have, I guess.
It did, but also I think toward the end of it, the motion picture industry started to get a little bit more sophisticated. You know something, Henry? I'm hang on a second here.
Yes, please.
I'm rude. There.
Oh.
How's that?
Thank you very much.
Sorry about that. I don't know what's happened to my manners.
Cheers to that. Sorry, a beer is always necessary at 10 minutes past 1 in the afternoon here in Sydney.
But I think that part of the thing happened is that the motion pictures started to become more sophisticated entertainment as the 50s went on, and there were some really worthwhile films. Some people were doing the films of Streetcar Named Desire and On the Beach and all the other social conscience films and the other good quality theatrical experiences that drew people back in. That you couldn't show on TV because one of the problems with broadcast television at that time, and also broadcast radio, was since it was offered free and you could pick it up out of the air, you couldn't have anything naughty on it. And so all the stations, networks adopted standards and practices, and so they had, really very bland.
They had to be safe, didn't they?
They had to be
mum,
safe.
Mum, dad, and the kids kind of stuff, right. Yeah?
And yeah, no naughty bits and no questioning and no issues. Gee, and so,
how that's changed. I mean, not on the big networks like NBC, ABC, CBS, because they still have to be careful, but because of cable.
Mm-hmm. Cable
can do whatever they want, basically.
Oh yeah, and so that was the early thing. The early days of cable was you could kick it on, and since you're paying for it, you had no complaint. And so you got to see all kinds of wonderful naughty bits in the sanctity of your own, and then videotape and all the the VHS tapes and all of that.
Yes. Isn't it interesting from a technical point of view, given that you are a science type? I remember in the early 80s when videotape came out, late 70s in America, I think, and there was a big war between Beta and what's the other one? Betamax?
Well, and VHS. Yes.
VHS
won, and it's not because Betamax was the better format. It actually had Sony had banked everything on having a high-quality image, high-quality reproduction. There was another one for a while that was really weird. Was the it was disc. It was not laser disc.
I know what you mean. Yeah, it's not mini disc, was it?
It was a very fine grooved platter that was
not mini disc. No, I think that's audio.
You played it on. It was like a record player. It had a stylus that went on it. And later on there was laser disc that came out. That was a. But the VHS, the reason people liked VHS was because it was variable speed, and if you slowed the speed down, you could record like two or three movies on one cassette. And it didn't matter if the more you slowed it down.
I remember that. You could do that, yes.
You could do that. You slowed it down, and then the image quality would be crap. They were going after quantity over quality. That was how people consumed it.
Someone said to me some years ago, they said, VHS was like the slut of the industry.
Yeah.
And it is worth noting that Betamax, of course, was used in television a lot because it was the better product.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that was one of the golden days. I had my apartment, and we discovered there was this a flea, what they call a flea market. It's a place that's a kind of a collective area where you have people sit, they set up their little booths and they sell.
Yeah, we're familiar with that. It's okay.
Yes.
Flea market's very common. Yeah.
Well, we had one flea market that we would go to, and it was this old guy. He was a retired history professor who was running he was also a science fiction fanatic. And that was a great period there. I could go to on a Friday afternoon, pop by and rent about six VHS tapes, most of them really high quality science fiction movies. And he had some great ones. I mean, I watched Frau im Mond, the German science the science fiction thing that was made in the Fritz Lang.
Fritz Lang, yeah.
He had a bunch of other high quality. Then he had all the old 50s and 40s and 50s TV shows that were kinescoped, and then they were transferred to VHS. So they looked terrible, but they were great because I could spend an entire weekend watching all these oldies but goldies science fiction films from him. He called it Stargate Video, but it was all on VHS. And then he wasn't making enough money selling straight science fiction, so he was under the counter selling porn. And on occasion he would get caught, and the vice squad would come in and shut his shop.
how much was it? Let's zoom to the late 80s, early 90s. How much was it to get the latest movie on VHS to rent?
It was about like $3 or $4.
Yeah, about the same here. About $5 or $6 Australian dollars. I would, when I was a young man, I think it was 1990, I went through a phase where if you went to the video shop, you could get the latest film that has now gone onto video, of course, for $6. Mm-hmm. But you could get all these foreign movies for $1. So I loved that because in those days, I can't watch subtitles on a movie now because I'm too busy on my computers and I can't do both. I can watch a movie on the television while I'm on the computer, but I can't read subtitles. But in those days, I had no computer, obviously. Uh-huh. And I got into all these French movies and French movies, fantastic European movies, and they were $1 a week. Uh-huh. It was great.
They were. Yeah, that's I did pick those up. They had them available by the time they had the company called Blockbuster Video, where you could go rent. And once again,
I think there's one Blockbuster still open somewhere in America. It makes TV news.
I think it was in Alaska.
It's barely America. But apparently you can see. Where is it? You can see from Alaska.
Sarah Palin's house. That's
it. Oh, you can see Sarah Palin's house from Alaska.
Yeah, right across the bay.
It's funny, those days of having to fast forward on a video. I mean, the kiddies now would find this very irritating.
Be kind, please rewind. That was the slogan they had on every box when you rented it. They asked you to please rewind.
Oh, that's right. Yes. And you had late fees and all sorts of things.
Just a fool in love with you. Earth angel, the one I adore. Love you forever and evermore. I'm just a fool in love. Of your love, loveliness, I hoped and I pray that someday I'll be the vision of your happiness. Oh, earth angel, darling dear, love you all the time. I'm just a fool in love with you.
I hope and pray that someday that I'll be the vision of your happiness.
Oh, Earth Angel, please be mine, my darling dear. Love you all the time. I'm just
Thomas Booker is Bondi Tunes International. He's our North American correspondent, and he joins us now from Texas.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with Thomas Booker, our correspondent in North America, and we're having a look at old times. I want to go back to post-war America and Britain, when you did have, as I referenced earlier on, white picket fences. And it was after the Second World War, the rations went on in Britain, as we mentioned, not so much or not for so long in America. And all of a sudden, it was like a movie. Everyone's happy. Everyone's buying more cars. Everyone's buying white goods. It seemed like a kind of utopia.
Well, it was because, I mean, but number one, the United States made it through World War II undamaged. So we were, none of our cities were bombed.
Except for Pearl Harbor.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that, they actually recovered that part of, you know, you're right, quickly too. But it, but in other words, the
by comparison to Britain and Europe, of course.
Yes.
Yes.
So, I mean, yeah, Europe, and they had a terrible time recovering from, because of the bloody nose they got there. And even Asia, I don't know if you remember, no, you're too young. And it used to be the slogan when we got, like, cheap toys and other, you know, cheap stuff, and it was always made in Japan, and that was the
that was the thing.
Yeah, Japan was trying to crank its industry up, and they were, you know, recovering from the rubble. And Germany was starting to revive the Volkswagen plant, and they were trying to sell Beetle. But the United States was undamaged. I mean, so they just, you know, just threw the switch when, you know, all the soldiers came back, and they had a domestic, and they started cranking, they started making cars and making appliances, and it was we had a
boom. It was a boom
huge time. Fabrication base, and so. We had washing machines. I mean, all these things were coming out that were had never been thought of before. I mean, dishwashers and washing machines and TV sets and, you know, transistor radios later from China, from Japan.
The 50s housewife was never happier.
Yeah. Yeah, vacuum cleaners. That was right. Mrs. Cleaver always used to vacuum the house in a skirt and wearing pearls. And yes,
as you do.
Of course, that was the way it was. But
that was, you know, I know that you're connected to a website on Facebook, and I can't remember the name of something of the atomic era. What's that called?
Oh yes, the it's the atomic. Oh gosh.
Anyway,
it's a retro site. Yes, I love it.
Very interesting stuff, because they show things like in the domestic kitchen that don't exist today. All sorts of things like swiveling fridges and an oven that you can access from both sides, and, you know, some really inventive stuff that doesn't exist anymore.
Yes. Yeah, I remember, see, my aunt, when we were living in New Orleans, my aunt had all those, because her husband was making it big in the oil biz. By the way, oil business was a huge industry that was cranking up. And
after post-Second World War.
So everybody was doing okay. I mean, there was no complaint. So they had all the gizmos and gadgets, and yes, she had the first dishwasher, which was a roll up to the sink, and other people had other kitchen gadgets and other amazing stuff going on, but yes, their gadgetry was there. Dryers, clothes dryers. I mean,
yes, was that a new thing?
It was a new thing. It was you didn't have to hang your clothes up, and you know that's something that became really absurd because you know now that we're having the energy consciousness and the conservation and everything else,
it
makes a great deal more sense to take your clothes outside and dry them in the sun.
Yes, absolutely, the irony of it all.
Nobody does that, and as a matter of fact, if some people, if they had houses, some of the housing developments will not allow any kind of clotheslines or anything outside the house because it makes it look cheap. It makes it low, you know. They're worried about property values being compromised.
Yes.
But that used to be the way. I mean, you didn't have a dryer and you didn't really need it, and you just took your clothes out. Even in wintertime, you could take them out there and they would dry. So that's
wonderful times, and there was a sense of happiness in the 1950s, Thomas, but it wasn't to last, and that I find interesting because I do get a sense that they had a false sense of security in the United States after the Second World War with all this booming stuff, and cars, cars. Yes. I mean, all of a sudden, a family could have two cars, not one, but two.
Yes, yes.
And of course, what would happen would be the husband would buy a new car and shove the old car off to his wife. Mm-hmm. And I think I did a mini doco on this about 10 years ago. Very interesting because this 1950s woman is in her kitchen doing the dishes where she belongs. Ha ha ha. And she's saying, isn't it wonderful? I have my own car now and I can go wherever I like and have coffee with Mrs. Simpson. And I'm thinking, gee, you must have been really imprisoned before you got the car, damn it.
Yeah, well, you watched the whole Mad Men series, so you did. Yeah, that was about that.
Oh yes, at that, yes.
Oh, by the way, the Facebook page is the Vault of the Atomic Space Age.
Yes,
it's a guy who collects all this ancient memorabilia from back then.
It's great stuff. I love it. And you often post stuff on Facebook, I just love. I don't know. Do you ever think that some people are just obsessed with the past? Because I am. I was born in 1962, 9 years after you.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was working on radio in the 1980s, I wasn't just a newsreader. I also did a show on another radio station connected with Nova where I was a newsreader. And I would play music from the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And the owner of the station didn't mind because we were an easy listening station. I was on from 7 p.m. till 1 in the morning. And at the top of the hour, I would actually connect with Nova, the main station, and read the news. And then I go back to my own. It was real networking, Thomas. Real networking, radio networking. But I was allowed to play 40s, 50s music, and I always felt that I lived in that time. And I often wish I did, actually. I'd be dead now.
First of all, if you're a white American living in that time, you're doing okay. It wasn't such a good time for the black people and Hispanic people and others of color. They had a bit more of a struggle to work their way up.
Talking of television, which we seem to be in the 1950s when television became popular, did you see black people on TV?
Only rarely. There was the occasion, I think it was 3 or 4 year stretch that Nat King Cole had, he had a variety show that was on. Mm. But they eventually had to cancel it because the sponsors were becoming increasingly worried that the southern states did not like the idea of having a black entertainer getting, sort of rehabilitating the image of black people in American living rooms. Mm. And
because they were always used as entertainers,
Yes, that was
in,
Yeah. But his show was good, and you know, he had regular other actors, other talent on it, but there was a kind of like a boycott that was started among sponsors to kill the show because they were afraid that the southern states would boycott it. Yeah, that's something to look up. So
it was the southern states mainly. Obviously, places like New York were more cosmopolitan.
Oh yeah, yeah, and they, you know, they had black neighborhoods and they were used to them. And when I was a kid, you know, a significant portion of my life, of the portion where I was probably most influenced, was when I was growing up in New Orleans. And but then I didn't realize it as a kid, all the strife that was going on there. But yes, they did have segregation. They had whites only water fountains and all the.
Were you old enough to understand this?
I started to be old enough to understand Martin Luther King, and I did watch his. And then later on, as I progressed into the 60s and the public institutions that I was attending tended to become more threatened by it, I started seeing, getting kind of like this suggestion that maybe that the, you know, that Martin Luther King might have been a great guy, but he's, you know, he's really screwing up his movement, and everywhere he goes after he's been there, there's always a riot and all this kind of thing. So there was a backlash in general in society, a discomfort because of that. And then later on became the anti-war demonstrations.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown. Accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are changing. Come writers and critics, you prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. And the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are changing. Come senators and congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorways, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. There's a battle outside and it's raging. It'll soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are changing. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, don't criticize what you can understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can lend your hand. For the times, they are changing. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. Slow one now will later be past, as the present now will later be past. Your old road is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, for the times, they are changing.
This is Thomas Booker, North America correspondent for Bondi Tunes International in San Antonio, Texas, also once known as San Antonio de Bejar, named for a Spanish duke from the city of Bejar in Spain. I come from family in North Texas and Northern Louisiana. I attended technical school in San Antonio, then started a career in research and development for a San Antonio-based company from which I am recently retired. That career saw me working on instrument development in the areas of geophysics, space sciences, material sciences, and material synthesis. All that took 40 years out of my life. I always wanted to move away from San Antonio, if not Texas, but I always found the opportunities in life here and not elsewhere. I've been places, but there ain't no reason to talk about them now. I have read things, watched things, and somehow managed to learn things, but there ain't no reason to talk about them now. I cover the south central part of the USA and other parts as required, and I mean to convey the honest truth about situations and matters, but there ain't no reason to talk about them now. I'm Thomas Booker, Texas correspondent, and I am Bondi Tunes International.
From Australia, this is Bondi Tunes.
I'm going to talk about the Korean War in a second, but I want to ask you, your parents, you said you grew up in New Orleans,
which is a
southern state in America. Mm-hmm. Were your parents left, politically, leaning to the left or the right?
The mainstream, my parents were very, very mainstream. And so they voted Republican because that was normal, but that was the Eisenhower Republican.
A different kind of Republican.
So basically it was conservative, but it was, you know, controlled and level-headed. And my father was very trusting in institutions. He came out of the military and he basically, because he went through the war and everything, he learned to respect
What did he do in the war?
Well, he didn't. What happened was he was a pilot in C-47s. He was undergoing training.
Yeah.
And there was a turning point in the war in the year 1943 when things really, that was when the United States was suddenly able to have its industry really chugging along, and they were really cranking out resources, and they were having to come up with methods of basically how they were going to go to war. And one of the things that had never been done before that they were having to kind of invent on the fly. So the people they had going through training classes there were actually not training. They were kind of helping invent this process. But he was a transport pilot. And I'm trying to remember the name of the base, but it was in North Carolina, I believe. Mm. It was a special base set aside to train airborne infantry and also all the support for the airborne infantry. And there was an occasion.
And what years were they?
He made it to the training base in 1943. He got his, he became a flying officer, got out of cadet school, and he was fully qualified pilot. A long time ago, I used to resent this whole thing. I thought somebody really screwed up on him. But then the more I learned about it, I don't know if you've ever seen Band of Brothers.
No.
What series about the weird? Everything then was new. Everything, I mean, they're going to war in this particular manner. It had never been done before. This is the first time they had sophisticated aircraft and
It's worth noting that America joined this war later. Mm-hmm. 39 to 45
right.
are the years of that war. I think America didn't join till
1941. Well, actually, they did 41. Join. Yeah, it was 1941. Well,
so
December of 1941, but they started the war in 1942, and then they had to mid 1943, and that was when my father was sent to this training base. And so, one of the training missions he had, they had taken some artillery field pieces and loaded it into his C-47. And they said that, we need to have you transport this, and it's going to go to this particular airport, and we're going to have this as an exercise. So that he flew a very, very overloaded airplane, a C-47.
Right. Where did you fly to?
Well, he flew to it was also in North Carolina or South Carolina. I'm fuzzy about it. I know it was one of the Carolinas where they had this training operation. Once again, it was an entire operation. It wasn't training. It was actually inventing a process. Yeah. He went into something that's known as a ground loop. And I've seen videos of a C-47 going. It was a characteristic of a twin-engine tail dragger that a C-47 was. And because of the load of the plane, he didn't have the feel for the landing characteristics, and so he went into a ground loop in the aircraft.
That sounds scary.
No, it is scary, because what happened was it went off the runway and slammed. It was out of control. He was like all over the place. The landing gear went off into rough ground at full speed, landing speed. The undercarriage collapsed. The whole plane came down on it. The control console collapsed. So he had all this equipment there that was literally the dashboard of the airplane, crashed on his leg and almost homogenized. And then the airplane was full of aviation grade, 100 octane gas. And the plane was just sitting there after it had crashed, and he was trapped in the cockpit. And had it caught on fire, you wouldn't be talking to me right now, because he would have been stuck there. And those planes.
So how did he come out of this?
Oh, he had to go. He had to undergo a couple of years, two or three. Oh, I think 4 years of rehabilitative therapy. They were going to cut one of his legs off, but an orthopedic surgeon in one of the hospitals intervened and said that he was determined to save the legs. So he. But he had to go through all kinds of reconstruction, and at the end of it, the badly affected leg was a couple of inches shorter. By the time they were done with it, because they were doing all sorts of knitting and tucking and bone grafting, so he always from thereafter he walked with a limp, a distinct limp, and he had to order special orthopedic shoes. He had a prescription for his shoes that he would send to Fort Worth when it was time for him to get other new shoes, and they were kind of like sort of boots that he wore.
And so bigger heels, that kind of thing.
One compensated for the height of his shortened leg, and then the other one was for his steps and everything. So that was the rest of his life. He was gimpy.
What did he do, he was a pilot, this accident happened, what did he do in terms of work after rehabilitation?
He rehabilitated in Leesville, Louisiana, and then he went to Houston and he got a degree in accounting, because we had this thing called the GI Bill. That was another really astonishing thing that was happening, was that at the end of the war, people were subsidized to go to college. And so, in the face of having an industrial boom, construction boom, the interstate highway system was being planned and implemented, and also they paid soldiers coming out to go to college. And so they subsidized everybody's education for a four-year degree, and as a result, they were cranking out executives and people working in office workers and managers and directors and engineers, all this talent was cranked out. And my father went out with a cum laude in accounting. And then he...
It's a very different kind of job from being a pilot.
Yeah, it is. And then he also, prior to the war, he had oil field experience. So he wound up going into the oil field business. As a matter of fact, he joined his brother for a little while in the oil field offshore drilling, which was another thing cranking up as a result of the war. They had the technology there to begin building offshore oil platforms, for better or for worse. But that was another technology, and that was another big boom that people were getting into. So they were now starting to drill offshore. And so he was in the Gulf of Mexico working with his brother, keeping track of supplying these offshore platforms and taking out tool and equipment and resources and boats.
We've only got about 5 minutes left. A very interesting story about your father. Just quickly, what was your mother doing during this time?
She was a stay-at-home mother for a while, but then she was a school teacher.
Right.
So she spent 30 years as an educator, and when we got set up, she wound up becoming a principal of a school district in a small town in Kerrville. By 1968, her career kind of ended in 1968. But she had been reared. Also, she had met him because she was in the Houston area, because she was working in the shipyards. and she was there was a part sorting task that she had. It was on accounting. It's kind of like you had a stock room, and they had a build, and they sent an order for all the parts that had to go into this particular build, and she was managing the selecting the parts and checking them out and keeping the inventory and all of this for the shipbuilding in Beaumont, Texas. So
she was very, very much a working person herself.
Oh, yes.
Just before we go, I want to quickly mention the Vietnam War. Now, I've been to Vietnam, I've been to Ho Chi Minh, and I've been to see the War Museum, mm-hmm. which is horrific, to say the least. Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me is that Australia was involved in this mm-hmm. war.
Oh, yes.
And America was involved in this war. But Britain was not involved in this war. And I thought we had this triangular thing going on, Thomas Booker. But Britain seemed to get out of it. That was really a dreadful war that Americans certainly didn't win. In fact, I don't think anyone won
really, did they? Nobody came out in the end of it. And I think the real villain of that whole business was France. I blame the whole Vietnam War on France.
Is that right?
And by virtue of the fact, I've never been able to understand this, but France had been gone through being occupied by Germans, and their nation was under control of another country, and they were subject to it and subordinated to it, and they had all these glorious, Vive la France and Vive la Résistance and all of this.
Yes, all that stuff.
You remember all that? And at the end of the war, they were so prideful and everything. And then they turned around and went to Vietnam and said, you belong to us. And, started doing to Vietnam what the Nazis did to France. And then expecting...
So, we must talk about that in more detail another day. But let's just blame the French anyway.
Yeah, that's good. They were easy to beat up on anyway.
Thomas, it's so good that you spent so much time talking with me here on Bondi Tune. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this was really pleasant. I have a trip down memory lane. I liked it.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.
Kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time. Haven't felt like this, my dear, since can't remember when. It's been a long, long time. You'll never know how many dreams I dreamed about you. Just how empty they all seemed without you. So kiss me once, then kiss me twice. Kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time. We'll be right back.
Harry James and Helen Forrest. It's been a long, long time. Thank you so much to our North America correspondent, Thomas Booker, in San Antonio in Texas for this 1 hour special on the 20th century. We'll do many more. A word about our website. Well, it's really our podcast site. If you go to bonditunes.podbean.com, that's bonditunes.podbean, podbean.com, you can hear all our chat shows on demand. And also we have a 1 hour music show, which airs music between the 40s and the 90s. And that's a lot of fun, I gotta tell you. Thank you for joining us. This has been a production for Bondi Tunes International.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International.
The sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.